Paper 119, section 4, which is old single column, page 1313. Kind of a fun page number. All right, so we're ready to start the fourth bestowal. So remember that you're beginning the transition here with this bestowal between the sort of earlier regime of bestowals and the later regime. Where now he's moving into, a much more definitively downstepped series of bestowals. We'll touch on it a few times, so everyone, if you don't have the little handout that just lists the bestowals to help remind you, what was each one of them. We will refer to that as we get in here a little bit. So I don't want to, talk about the details anymore. Let's just jump in, and we'll reflect some more on exactly what that transition amounts to when we get into it here a little bit. All right.
The fourth bestowal. It was at the end of one of the periodic millennial roll calls of Yabursa that Michael proceeded to place the government of Nebadon in the hands of Emmanuel and Gabriel. And of course, recalling what had happened in times past, following such action, we all prepared to witness Michael's disappearance on his fourth mission of bestowal. And we were not long kept waiting, for he shortly went out upon the Salvington dispatching field and was lost to our view. On the third day after this bestowal disappearance, we observed in the universe broadcast to Yabursa this significant news item from the seraphic headquarters of Nebadon, reporting the unannounced arrival of an unknown seraphim accompanied by a solitary Supernaphim and Gabriel of Salvington. This unregistered seraphim qualifies as of the Nebadon order and bears credentials from the Universa Ancients of Days, certified by Emmanuel of Salvington. This seraphim test out as belonging to the Supreme Order of the Angels of a local universe and has already been assigned to the core of the teaching counselors.
Okay, let's just stop there for a second. And, remember, one of the things that we're doing here is we're attempting to try to tease out as many initial clues as we can, knowing that we may not be able to really run with any, but you want to always be challenging yourself to try to notice little details, because remember, like we said when we started this paper, he stated it and then reiterated it, that he's going to try to push what is in a pretty extreme limitations in the revelatory mandate about what he can say. He's going to try to push that those limitations to their limits. And so, it's always worth trying to see if there's even the littlest little thing. Maybe, it will add up to some bigger recognition. So we're always looking for little details. Now, so he's bestowing himself as a seraphim. And they tell you that, I don't know if you remember how it works with seraphim, when the creative mother spirit creates them, they are immediately tested for their initial nature, because they're not uniform in initial nature. They break up into seven categories. Now they all challenge themselves to function in the different categories going forward from there. But just like you and I, we all start out with some genetic starting point. And the last thing you want to do is think of that as your eternal expression. It's just, you know, your beginning point. And one of those orders that they break up into is the supreme seraphim. And amongst all those supreme seraphim, there's a number of different tasks that they take on. One of them is what they're referring to here, the teaching counselors. So as a supreme seraphim, and you notice that they immediately tested him, see which category he fell into, he's going to function as a teaching counselor. Now, it's interesting to note, and here's where I just remind yourself, you know, what's happening with, you know, with this bestowal. So the fourth bestowal, this is the one where he is going to incorporate the Son Spirit likeness of supremacy into his being. And it's just kind of an interesting little side note that another one of those subcategories, another one of those job descriptions of the supreme seraphim, there's one called Sun Spirit Ministers. So even though he's not doing that, it's interesting to note, see, that he is a seraphim where, you know, so, you know, even though we don't know a lot about all the details of these differences and whatnot, there clearly is something of similarity to his Sun Spirit mission in being a supreme seraphim. You know, you could speculate on that. Maybe there's something about that that helps with that, if after all, one of the things that they do is, you know, is serve as quote-unquote Sun Spirit ministers. So, there's basically everything that you can think of to look at like this matches this pattern. You know, it's a very, very definitive pattern, like we talked about a couple weeks ago. And again, as long as you're looking at this, you know, you notice right away that this is, you know, the transition where we've, you know, he's descending downward, and that fact is very definitively reflected in that the associated angel that's paired with him on the mission, you know, is going up. So you're at the supernafim now. You're at the highest angels. He's got a primary supernafim with him.
Is there two halves of the supreme, as well as there two halves of the Marantia life of Jesus?
Well, no, I mean, there really isn't two halves. I mean, there's seven facets. That's why we have seven bestowals. There's seven facets of supremacy that he is engaging one at a time. Okay? You know, that's always the overriding thing. Remember that there's all kinds of secondary things in play, but the primary thing that he's attempting to do, he's trying to incorporate supreme type deity into his being. Okay? And he's doing it one step at a time.
The categorization that you referred to as the Sun Spirit, mm-hmm. Seraphim,
You can go back and read. They help out with you know, higher sun-like and spirit-like personalities. They're always ministering in some way or another. I mean, in that one, you know, it's very directly. They just call them ministers. They're ministering to higher, for instance, a Vonal Sun. When they're on, on missions, you know, that sort of thing. You know, they're remember, almost always you've got some contingent of some kind of angel that's helping out with these various bestowal missions. Like one of the things we're going to read about is, you know, here as a teaching counselor, he's helping out a Trinity teacher son on one of his missions to a world. When an Avonal son goes to a world, you've got a cadre of angels that go with him. When an Adam and Eve go to a world, they have a you know, a whole bunch of angels that go with them. You know, you almost always have this whole group of seraphim that are, you know, helping out with, you know, all of the complexities of these missions.
Are they periodically assigned to those groups, or are they specialized to begin with?
The different subcategories, like the different, you know, job types of the Supreme, I mean, that's not genetic, you know, that's not reflecting so much their nature, but just their, you know, an assignment. Because notice how they said this, he's tested out as a pre-mortar, and he's assigned to the Corps of Teaching Counselors. An angel is definitely trying to, you know, if they're initially, say, functioning as a supreme one, you know, they'll want to, at some point, be involved in the planetary missions, you know, and so they want to try to flesh out their whole angelic nature by challenging themselves to engage as many of these facets, you know. So it's just like between here and Gerasim, you're going to try to transcend your initial genetic abilities and try to broaden yourself out, you know, into those areas that initially you just have no, you know, real ability, and you might not even be able to develop a skill in it. You know, no matter how hard you try, it's just not there. The potential's not there in this mortal life. But you get to the mansion worlds, and you're more liberated from these, you know, these limitations, and you can really get the whole mortal life fleshed out. You know, you won't necessarily do everything that a mortal could do, it's the same thing here. There's just a lot of similarities with the way angels are created and the way we end up being, you know, procreated. Okay, so we'll talk about Gabriel in a second when that comes up. But anyway, just notice, you know, again, and remember that the way the angel attendance is with him. You know, in this case, it's a Sapernaphim, because it's a lone Sapernaphim. A lone Sapernaphim is not synchronized with the Father's circuits, so, you know, that doesn't mess up, you know, the effort here to just engage Son Spirit likeness. Remember when we talked about that? So it's a, you know, you want to definitely think about, you know, if the Sapernaphim and Michael are both, you know, definitively either not in tune with or have set the Father aspect aside, who's taken up that slack? And that's where Gabriel comes in. All right, let's read a little more here.
Michael was absent from Salvington during this, the seraphic bestowal, for a period of over 40 standard universe years. During this time, he was attached as a seraphic teaching counselor, what you might denominate a private secretary, to 26 different master teachers, functioning on 22 different worlds. His last or terminal assignment was as counselor and helper, attached to a bestowal mission of a Trinity teacher's son on world 462 in system 84 of constellation 3 in the universe of Nebadon.
Just one little thing. Does anyone remember? 40 Nebadon years is, you know, roughly how many of our years? You remember what the ratio is? No? 5 to 1, right, 5 to 1. So it's how long? Yeah, it's about 200 years. So this one, see, remember how we've noticed that there's been a number, they're kind of in the sort of 100, you know, 90, whatnot, ballpark. So this one is, you know, like double that. This is a much longer thing. And it's obviously going to be necessary if he's going to, do 26 different missions here. Now you could say, well, why does he have to do 26? And again, that's going to be something that they aren't allowed to reveal. But that it's not going to be just, well, I finally just got tired and that's how many I, had by the time I, I mean, there's going to be something very definitive to it. He's probably very carefully picking each of those 26 missions because it helps with a certain sub-facet of this sun-spirit facet that he's trying to engage so that over the course of the whole, spanning that whole spectrum, he and his Supernafim companion are able to get a full synchronization with what he's trying to incorporate into his being.
That is. Chris, when they talk about millennial roll calls.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Remember how the inner circuit of Avona, which is roughly a 1,000-year time period, creates a periodicity to the grand universe in a lot of ways. Here's one they're mentioning. That they're, every day, a day is like 1,000 years. Every sort of grand cycle here, everyone takes a brief census. Okay, who all is in Super Universe number 7 right now? They're trying to keep a tally on all of the countless quintillions of beings that are shuffling all over all the time. So there's a quick little head count, on that particular day in the life of Orvinton, who was out and about, amongst the local universes.
This is constellation 3. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that these constellations are numbered in the order that they were peopled.
One can,
that's an assumption.
We never know, you never know quite how to, there's probably some initial linearity to this, but then, it's not like number one is going to get fully done before number two starts. That's not happening. But it gives you a rough sense. It's going to be one, it's probably a constellation with some pretty old worlds in it, at least in some of the systems. But there's going to be some pretty newer systems in there, too. So,
the Master Spirit firing order is pretty scrambled.
This particular world is quite a ways down the road relative to us, because they're getting a Trinity teacher son. So,
that doesn't necessarily mean there's enlightened life.
Right? No, this is right before, this is the stage before light and life,
Never throughout the 7 years of this assignment was this Trinity teacher son wholly persuaded as to the identity of his seraphic associate. True, all seraphim during that age were regarded with peculiar interest and scrutiny. Full well, we all knew that our beloved sovereign was abroad in the universe, disguised as a seraphim. But never could we be certain of his identity. Never was he positively identified until the time of his attachment to the bestowal mission of this Trinity teacher's son. But always throughout this era were the supreme seraphim regarded with special solicitude, lest any of us should find that we had unawares been host to the sovereign of the universe on a mission of creature bestowal. And so it has become forever true concerning angels that their creator and ruler has been in all points tried and tested in the likeness of seraphic personality.
Everyone I could hear was kind of chuckling a little bit. It's really funny. They're all on their best behavior here, not solicitude, but special solicitude, watching every dot on every I, and, they are really on their best behavior. This is pretty funny.
Which is good for us to take into consideration. You never know the sacredness of another personality you're encountering.
Yeah, we all know there's kind of a long-standing notion about that, you know, that if you really are serious about being a child of God, you should always act as if, you know, the Master was there with you. You know, would you be on your best behavior? And then, of course, the revelation just, you know, brings this out in spades. I mean, there are countless beings that are aware of every thought, you know, and every action. You know, these are, you know, everything is being recorded. You know, this aspect of what you're thinking is being recorded by those beings. And, I mean, you know, this whole notion that humans have of privacy and all that sort of stuff, I mean, the universe doesn't follow all these notions. I mean, you're an open book. There isn't anything that you've ever thought, you know, that isn't out, you know, and about. That's now, obviously, obviously a lot of stuff, you know, they don't, you know, it's like, whatever, okay. you know, waiting for something worth recording here or worth remembering. You know, and it's not like they
have to wait a long time.
You know, it's not like they don't know that, you know, they engage us the same way we engage a kid with poopy diapers, you know. It's not like they haven't seen this and heard this all before. You know, it's not like you should be embarrassed, you know, if you have some animal thought or something, you know. It's, you know, it's all irrelevant to them. But this whole notion that we have that, you know, it's like, well, those are my thoughts. You're not allowed to, you know, listen in on my phone conversation. I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, they do a lot more than listen in on your phone conversations, okay? They listen in on everything you think. I mentioned it last week, but
oh, they're... They say it's sad to record.
Yes. Yes. remember last week I pointed out what they're doing with these quote-unquote things all through these, you know, the last section, the last bestowal, and going forward here, where they're alluding to the passage in the book of Hebrews, where the author of Hebrews is... you know, is basically making this point that in all points, tried and tested. And the funny thing that they're doing with that passage, and I wanted to mention it again specifically because this is the real punchline of what they're doing, where the author in Hebrews starts out one of their sentences. I have to look over my glasses. It's tiny print. Let's see here. Where he says, "For surely it is not angels he helps." You know, the point he's making is, you know, this is all about humans, this whole bit of experiencing, you know, so that he can fully appreciate what humans have to go through. Not only is it for angels, but one of his bestowals was as an angel. So it's just like with the Melchizedek thing, you know, like I pointed out, the... You know, saying, well, you know, that passage in Hebrews, you know, not only is he like, you know, he actually was a Melchizedek in one of his bestowals. So, you know, they're just playing off of that. None of these are sort of quotes out of the Bible. They're just hearkening to that passage and creating a little paraphrase, you know, over and over again, relative to the particular bestowal.
I'm just curious why the... peculiar interest and scrutiny of that age?
Oh, just, I mean, they're all curious as, no, I'll get out, you know. I mean, they are trying to figure out which seraphim is Michael.
But it says all seraphim, the boy.
Yeah.
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 All seraphim during that age. Oh, because they're trying to figure
out. Right, they're just, you know, they're just all over this, you know, with every magnifying glass they can find, trying to, you know, and the, like they said, I mean, no one was, he, and again, why do they make such a point out of that? Because again, they're trying to stress in all points, tried and tested, in the likeness of seraphic personality, he is absolutely not distinguishable, even to the most extreme experts, from every other seraphim. He is a perfect seraphim. He's not just a facsimile of a seraphim. You know, Michael in seraphim clothing. He is literally a seraphim through and through. And this gets even more so as we go into the next two bestowals. Challenge yourself to let the incarnation mystery be a deep, deep, impenetrable mystery. Don't say, he could have kind of fudged it and then it wouldn't be quite so mysterious. No. I mean, that's not the point. The point is to try to wrap your mind around how he can literally be one of these phenomena, like here in Seraphim. And let me just mention it right here, as long as we're kind of stressing this. Think about what's different right off the bat between this bestowal and the previous three. Okay, so the first one, he's a Melchizedek son. Second one, he's a Lenonadec son. Third one, he's a material son. Okay, Michael is one of the parents of those three types of beings. I mean, he's a soul, creator of material sons and daughters. Okay, so, I mean, for him to be a Melchizedek or a Lenonadec or a material son, he's taking on the nature of someone that he created. So it's not that deeply mysterious in that regard how he could somehow morph himself into that likeness. I mean, he morphed himself into that, quote unquote, when he created that being. Part of him went into that being to create it. So there's already something like him in it. And that fact is reflected, again, there's the all of the endless patterns of this. Notice that the Father is in those first three. Okay? See, the being that he chose to be in that bestowal synchronizes then with what he's trying to do. His father likeness, his father-son type deity as a creator son, his father likeness, his initiator likeness, initiated those three types of beings. See, so, I mean, the type of being is synchronized with what's going on too. If he's doing initiator-like stuff in those first three, there's father-likeness, involved in those first three. Well, he initiated those three types of beings that he's in those three. See, so everything, everything you can think of, works here. But you go, you go to a seraphim, he has nothing to do with creating a seraphim. And seraphim are created solely by a creative mother spirit. So from this point out, he is, out of his water, so to speak. He didn't create, literally, put his nature into the next four creatures he's going to be. This is getting to be deeply mysterious. What on earth, how is it that he has something within him that can morph into something that is not his progeny? I mean, obviously it's got to be going the other way around the ellipse, so to speak, I mean, you're not taking the direct path because there is no direct path. The only way to connect, for him to connect to that, he's got to go back around through, the first source and center where everything comes back together again and then come back out again to engage something that's, on a totally parallel line to him. There's not a direct lineage down to a seraphim that he's, he's part of. So you're getting these very non-linear phenomena starting to happen, these very, elliptical, like we've tried to talk about them, phenomena happening. Okay.
So it's his personality that's being incarnated in these different forms.
Let's stress that again. One of the deepest universal, independent of the bestowal, one of the deepest aspects of the mysteriousness of these mysteries, of the mystery of the incarnation, is how a creator personality can be a creature. Because remember, there's just one, amongst first source personalities, there's just one distinction. You have creator personalities and creature personalities. You don't have male and female personalities or anything else that you can think of, seraphim personalities and human personalities. I mean, the only thing that delineates is creator personalities and creature personalities coming from the first source.
Really fundamental.
That is the fundamental distinction in personality. So this is what's the most deeply mysterious to all beings thinking about this. How is this possible? How can a creator personality function as a creature personality? That's a non sequitur. Doesn't that violate the law of identity? Isn't that fundamentally illogical? Well, again, you know it can't be. And you already, like we just pointed it out, you already know fundamentally how it is possible, even in the first place. Because you got to go back around. You got to get at it the other way around the ellipse. No, if you have creator personality in this definitive line and creature personality in this definitive line, well, they both, you can follow them back to the source. You know, so he's got to go back, you know, and then come back out again. You know, he's, in all of these, he is somehow, you know, basically resetting his personality and re-expressing his purposiveness. Okay? So he is very much letting go of any sort of linearity that you can imagine in, you know, in reality.
So he's well connected.
Yeah, yeah. Very well connected. You know, and then it just gets even more, see, now, and again, as we go to these last four, you know, like think of this one. This is just the Son Spirit. So, and you know, you're thinking, well, okay, through the Father I could get back out. Well, now the Father's not involved directly, but he's still coming out as a creature. See, it's getting more and more deeply mysterious what on earth he's doing here. See, and that's why I'm saying you got to really go back. You got to go. You got to go back past the Universal Father. You really need to get back and come back around the ellipse the other way. You need to get at this thing more in the from the Trinity side than the first center side, in order to have this additional stuff in play. You know, and there's no way none of us can even remotely know exactly what we mean by that. But you've got to really reset here in terms of how you're basically expressed and get back in so that you can express in a fundamentally different way.
I'm thinking that with the seraphim connection, the mother's got to be offering him a way to come into her womb, so to speak, to manifest into the seraphim. So through her doorway, he's got to be manifesting and taking his personality and somehow creating the seraphim.
Right. I mean, see, yeah. See, that's another one where you. You know, when you just think about this particular bestowal and me saying, well, you know, it must have something to do with more of a Trinity route around the ellipse than a first center route around the ellipse. Well, and the Trinity is the root of Mother, see? See, that's what I'm, you know, it's one of the reasons why you know there's something like that going on. It's not always trivial, though, you know, to think about, but you can begin to get a little sense of how, okay, this is completely, you know, even I can imagine how maybe I could get at this. But the more you try to think about every one of them, you know, it's like, well, that works for that one, but that doesn't really work for that one. How do I understand that one? It's all, you know, there's always going to be a mystery point if you push it too far. But you can begin to see, get a sense. See, you know, even you just thinking about it, you know, could tell that was one of the things that was going on there.
What was it about this attachment to the Trinity teacher son that made him identifiable, finally?
The reason is because that's his last one, so he leaves out of that one. Bye, I'm out of here, back to Salvington.
Oh.
And everyone, oh, that was...
Oh. So when he finished.
Right, when he finished. See, that's why I said, you know... Throughout the 7 years of this assignment, you know, never, see, was the Trinity teacher's son. See, even the Trinity teacher's son, who can assess pretty subtle things,
yeah.
You know, Trinity teacher's son.
Sure enjoyed having this seraphim. You know.
Man, this is a really, really fine seraphim.
Yeah.
You know.
That's all I can tell.
You know, but then when he says, okay, well, yeah, then everyone goes, oh, no wonder it was such a... it was Michael. Yeah.
I believe that there is a sanctity of personality and a sanctity of mind that keeps lives private in the universe, and that everybody that walks by you, every angel, every being, doesn't see through you like a sheet of glass.
No, it's not like that. That's not what we're talking about. Go back and read, you know, about the higher angels and what they do. You know, you've got a particular type of Sakanafim, say, that is conscious of every single being in a particular way, like, say, relative to mercy. They are aware of everything that you do relative to mercy.
That you do.
And you do that as a person. Think.
That's an observable fact.
Doing, you know, the doing, the internal doing, not they're not observing material things.
Chris,
you know, they're observing mindal things. You know, I mean, they're sensing you mindally. They're the ministers of the mind womb of the super universe, of the seven reflective mother spirits. So they can tune in non-locally, you know, reflectivity wise. And they, you know, it's just like, I mean, think of another one. You know, if not you, think about a creator son. You've got those high angels that are synchronized with a creator son. So if an Ancient of Days wants to know what Michael of Nebadon, you know, wants, you know, to connect to him, he can, all he has to do is approach that angel, and he's got a direct expression of Michael. So you have to allow that which is of value is known. The things that you're just doing run of the mill as a person, no one is trying to know. I mean, it's irrelevant. But Lucifer, I mean, long before anyone locally had any clue, those on high, remember, they knew a long time before that all was not right, because they can see his consciousness. They're, you know, they're in tune with his consciousness. They know it's not going well. But do they intervene? No. I mean, they knew long before anyone else that he was going to rebel. You know, they don't give anyone any warning on that, because that's not the way the universe works. Universe is an evolutionary phenomenon, you know, and it plays out.
Chris?
Yeah.
Maybe if I'm my understanding him or interpreting it, that even though the angels don't give us privacy between angels, but they do give us privacy between other humans, isn't that
what? Well, I mean, think about one, you know, one of the ways that he, you know, the most bringing up there. Your guardian angels are not inside your head, okay? They're not inside your consciousness, you know? You're not possessed by an angel, you know, like you had no personality, no force fields, you know, and a secondary midwayer was in there, you know, manipulating you and fully aware of everything in your consciousness. You know, your angels do not engage you like that. Remember, they tell you that point blank, okay? It's not like they're there. But see, the amazing thing is the really local phenomena are giving you a sanctity of personality. But on high, you know, you go up the angels a bit, you know, and there's some angel higher up the rank that is just tuned right into your consciousness in a particular aspect of it, you know, even though that local seraphim is totally, you know, backed away. So see, there's just this whole hierarchy of how you're known. You know, the father could have kept all this to himself, so only the father would know. But remember, he divested himself of everything that he could. One of the things he divested himself of was some of this penetrating knowing. There's some things about you that he doesn't know directly, like he doesn't engage you temporally. Okay, but you know, there are beings that do engage you temporally and know you temporally. You know, but he divested himself of that ability. You know, and he had to, because he needed to free himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. So, I mean, he certainly can't have a temporal boat anchor hanging on him. You know, he's never going to free himself from unqualified infinity, let you know, if he's not even freed from finity.
Chris, could it be the case that this happens with the top two adjutants of worship and wisdom, the domain where personality functions? Below that, what are they recording? Chemical reactions and neurological...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, a lot of this stuff is just not... I mean, remember, they give you a little... Yeah, I think I know what you're thinking of there. You know, think about locally. The creative mother spirit, is... there's a much more of a personal consciousness of you via the sixth and seventh adjutants. You know, it's... she isn't personally engaging every animal. First of all, that's illogical because they're not a person, so she can't personally engage them. So, you know, she doesn't have a personal consciousness of, you know, every animal in Nebadon. But she has a sub-personal, a mindal energy connection with everyone. I mean, it's her mind. And you're watching some animal, that's not the animal's mind, that's her mind. So obviously she's aware of that in a sub-personal way. But she's not reflecting on what each animal's doing. You know, it's just a given engagement, you know, at a more mechanical-like level. But if it actually gets all the way down to the mechanical level, she's handed that off to the master physical controllers, to the mechanical controllers. They're the ones, you know, that are intimately engaged with every blade of grass and, you know, and all of us at our rudimentary mechanical level and everything. You know, so the functioning of the chemistry and stuff, if someone wanted to know that, the mechanical controllers are aware of the functioning of all biologic chemistry, they're not very personal, but... an associate power director could talk to them and get an assessment of what's going on. I mean, you know, so these things can be known at all levels, but not all this stuff is, you know, at this time, you know, a hydrogen atom interacted with it. You know, I mean, they're not recording all this stuff, you know.
Awful waste of recording
space. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. But it's all... I mean, the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. I mean, beings are aware of everything. Yeah. Yeah.
Jerry?
Yeah, Jerry? Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, you start looking at some of that stuff, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, it's really kind of shocking initially when you start reading just how many things are recorded and how, you know, how much detail. There is a lot about your life that is very intimately known. You know, and just maybe one more thing so we don't beat this to death. But, you know, you can always remind yourself that the mind, the adjutant mind, you know, where your consciousness is not yours. It's nonsensical to think that somehow is isolated. It's part of a contiguous energy system that fills all of Nebadon. It's her mind. She can't not be aware of it. There's no way for her to, you know, to wall that off. I mean, if she somehow walled it off, that means you'd come unplugged. You wouldn't have mind. I mean, you know, it's impossible for her to shield herself from every being in the universe. It's her mind. Yeah.
If you're being observed on that close of a level, you don't want to be grossing out your unseen benefactors. You know, I mean, it just seems like there's another level of morality there.
There's an expression of that, what you're thinking of. You know, go back, if you remember, back in the, you know, in the more definitive Supreme Papers, remember when they say, are you really going to let down the Supreme Being who is all dependent upon, you know, your choices? And, you know, there is a very, very tight intimacy between you and the Supreme Being, not directly, but via the Almighty Supreme, via the Almighty, he is very dependent upon all things and beings in the grand universe. You know, and even if you don't assume a sense of duty because you know you're being watched, can you assume a sense of duty knowing how critical what you could be, if you choose, is to the whole? I mean, someone has to be part of the whole. The whole doesn't just magically come into existence. The whole is a synthesis of parts. You know, it needs parts to synthesize. You've been given the chance to be one of those parts. If you don't want to be, fine. You know, in that sense, parts is parts. You know, in the non-personal, almighty sense, parts is parts. The mother sees you otherwise because you're a person, the mother. And the mother would love you to choose to be more of a person because the mother would like to connect you to other persons. She's the individuality of the whole, you know. And we don't have any connection with each other except through the individuality of the whole. There's a number of points, if you think about it, where they try to challenge us with some really powerful verbiage in the book. To be motivated by something besides fear, you know, just sort of simple things like, well, I'm going to do that because I'll be embarrassed, you know, because I know someone's looking, you know, so therefore I'm going to behave, you know. All these simple sort of things that motivate a little child in childish ways, you know, they're trying to get you to feel a deeper sense so that you, you'll do these things for higher reasons. You'll want everyone to see what's in your consciousness. You better start wanting it pretty soon, because as a Marantia being, there's less and less of a difference between the inside and the outside. Okay, the outside is more and more the inside. Your body is basically mind-made substance. It's going to be a little bit hard to not have everyone see what's going on in your mind when your body is basically just, you know, your mind-made substance, Marantia substance. So, you know, start thinking about that, you know. Start being something that you would not want to hide anyone. Because eventually there is going to be no hiding. You know, you'll know as you are, you know, as you're known. You know, we know that. You know, when you get into Havona, you know, there's not going to be, you know, some little loincloth that's going to keep something protected, okay? You're going to be fully exposed for everyone to see, inside and out. Yeah, right. I mean, remember, there's all these issues of, you know, to help you kind of get re-rolling again in your Marantia body, you know, having those records of your life, of all the significant things that you can engage, you know, really catalyzes that process.
A lot of the other spiritual philosophies on the planet, there's a tremendous reference to halls of records.
Right. I mean, the simplest way to understand some vague, fuzzy notion like Akashic records or something like that, exactly, you know, is what I just pointed out. I mean, mind is not a little clod of something that's broken off and is rattling around inside your cranium. You know, there's one mind, you know. Every person that's ever lived on not just this world, but every world in Nebadon, you know, that life was lived by the Creative Mother Spirit. All of that is in her mind still. Every person that's ever lived, everything that's ever happened, it's all in her consciousness. This is why you can have all kinds of bizarre things happen if people don't have, you know, has localized a grip on the mindal energy system. They're kind of fuzzy and they start drifting off and randomly grabbing stuff. You know, they grab something related to some other being and, you know, at some other time, you know, especially it's not too far away if they're genetically similar, You know, they don't have to travel very far. They can grab a hold of that. They'll think it's something related to them. You know, I lived that life, or, you know, or I just, you know, tapped into the libraries of the cosmos or something. It's like, well, not really. You know, it's just, it's her consciousness. It's not really a library or anything. There are libraries where records are kept, but then there's her consciousness, which is perfect. You know, she doesn't forget anything. So it's all there.
So if you're having a negative thought about something and you recognize it and you change that thought, you're adjusting that thought, mm-hmm. something like that would get recorded, right?
Yeah, I mean, anything that you can identify a relationship to value, you know that's got to get recorded somewhere, somehow, by someone. That has greater significance.
So we should think at that point, though, that
But you just don't know where to draw the lines.
This drives right off a cliff if you take.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You don't know. I mean, obviously, you can't take this to the nth degree.
You do, and every thought, is not a plain glass window that every being in the universe is looking at. Maybe somewhere, someplace, it's all recorded.
No, it's not. See, again, don't think in dichotomy terms. See, this is always the challenge we always have in study groups, right? You know, when we try to introduce things new in the revelation, there's an immediate tendency for everyone to think in dichotomies. It's like, well, if you allow that, then there's nothing of that. It's like, no, you don't have to think black and white. You know, everything has a spectrum. Not absolutely everything is recorded, but that doesn't mean that there's some sort of really. It's not like there's not a lot of stuff recorded. There is an awful lot of stuff recorded, but where you draw the line.
Well, it has to have a value, right?
I mean, the easiest way to solve this problem is to not try to draw a line. Forget about drawing a line. Live as if everything is recorded and known. Why do you want to live thinking that something is sneaking past everyone? What the heck for? What do you need that for? What do you need that secret space for?
We don't.
You don't need a secret space.
I don't think I do.
So even if there is one, assume there isn't. You know? Live as if all is known. I mean, if no one else knows, you know. Is that not enough? Do you want to know that? Do you want to remember that? You know, if you don't live that. Don't do that. Don't be that. Be something, you know, that can be an open book.
This stuff is known by all these beings, or available to be known by all these beings. And for you, you know, to know that, like you said, why would you want to put anything over on anybody? Because that's counter to growth and...
I mean, it's obviously
evolution.
Potentially knowable. You could tell someone. You know it.
Right.
You could tell someone. Let's move on, but let me just make one more point that I should have made a long time ago here on this. Remember that one of the fundamental things that Revelation is trying to teach us that humans have never understood is that what the universe sees is what is, not what isn't. Okay? Most of the way humans assess themselves, see themselves, they see what they aren't. Okay, that's an illusion. The universe can't see what you aren't. They can only see what you are. Okay? So in terms of of recording you, you know, the first thing is, well, it's about a 0.005 watt bulb, okay? You know, that's the first thing they're going to notice. Okay. Yeah, a real dim bulb, okay. That's the first thing they notice with all of us. It's not a heck of a lot to record here. You know, remember, you know, even those who are recording some of the more micro details, initially, there's so little to record that you can be in a group with another 999, Okay? Not a heck of a lot, you know, worth recording there. You're a pretty limited phenomenon to start with. Okay? I mean, finally you get up to being a third circler, you know, and there's enough going on that it actually, you know, takes the full time of a pair of angels to keep up with it. Before that, you know, they can take coffee breaks a lot, you know, and you haven't moved. Okay? You know, they got to drive stakes to see if you're moving. So there's nothing to record. Yeah. You know, we have to all be humble about this. This is just, you know, 1,000, okay? That's a big number. You know, you're in a group of 1,000, for Christ's sake. Okay? You know, you may think that you're doing all kinds of groovy, great things, but you're, you know. All right.
If you consecrated yourself to God, you get your own pair of angels.
No. No, that's a spiritual consecration. You make the supreme decision. Okay, not just consecrating yourself. Yeah, I mean,
what's the difference?
I mean, I consecrate myself to God. I'm a seventh circler, and I'm just that. It's a, you know, your initial consecration is spiritual. Remember, there's a twofold consecration. There's that spiritual consecration. There's that consecration of your will. I will be part of eternity.
My will is to do your will.
Yeah. Okay. But nothing's actualized yet. It's just a will. Okay. That's not getting you a pair of angels. Okay. Angels relate to you as a cosmic phenomenon, not as a spiritual phenomenon.
And all those chances you took.
I want to refund.
That's the whole point of that. That's the whole point of, you know, again, the humans have never had the slightest notion of this. This is epical revelation. You know, it's a supreme, it's not only a supreme decision, it's the supreme decision. They tell you that'll get you a pair of angels. I mean, not only cosmic, but vastly cosmic. And in a very specific way. So, again, I mean, that's what's in play with the psychic circles. It's cosmic, not spiritual. You can be very, very spiritual and still a seventh circler. And be in a group of 1,000. Okay? Super spiritual. You're in a group of 1,000 because you don't have much cosmically happening yet. You got a lot of spiritual stuff happening, but not much cosmic yet.
What does that mean, cosmic?
Cosmic means that it's tuned to the harmony of the cosmos more. I mean that it's not just the spiritual fibers. Okay, it's not just love. For instance, it's loving service. It's not just loyalty. It's courageous loyalty. You know, you can be loyal, you know, which is coming from your spirit-like, you know, remember, matter, mind, spirit, spirit of loyalty here, okay? That's a spirit-like thing, but, you know, you could be loyal to things that that are swine and not pearls. You know, that's why Jesus said that. Don't cast your pearls before swine. Don't use your spirit of loyalty to be loyal to the muck, okay? Recognize the muck for what it is. You know, being able to recognize the muck for what it is and not casting your pearls before swine, now that is beginning some cosmic thinking. But if you just, I'm just going to indiscriminately love, okay, there's no cosmic thinking there. That's just spiritual thinking. You have to discriminate. You have to bring in material consciousness, individuality consciousness. You've got to differentiate. Okay?
And,
yeah. And then once you've differentiated, if you then bring spirit into play, post-differentiation, okay, now something cosmic is happening because there's individuality consciousness and unity consciousness in play. Yeah. And that, you know, that's going to take some wisdom. That's gonna take some growth. I mean, well, how do I know what's pearl and what's swine? And initially, it all seems, you know.
It's good for me.
Right. See, so, okay, not to belabor that, but that's the point.
As these successive bestowals partook increasingly of the nature of the lower forms of universe life, Gabriel became more and more an associate of these incarnation adventures, functioning as the universe liaison between the bestowed Michael and the acting universe ruler, Emmanuel.
Okay, I know we've just been talking, but I want one little additional thing with Gabriel that we want to bring up there. Remember, this is all he can tell you about what Gabriel is doing. This is not all of why Gabriel is involved. This is all he's allowed to tell you, right up to the limits. So we're trying to think, okay, so, you know, we're trying to look at the patterns, and we've talked about them. It's obvious one of the reasons Gabriel's involved in 4 through 7, because those are the ones where Michael is setting his father-likeness aside. Even in the 7th bestowal, he's born a babe, okay? Initially, the father, you know, consecration of his will to the will of the father is not initially happening. In all of those, it's obvious that because the Creator Son is not going to be the initiator in the bestowal phenomenon, there needs to be an initiator. Gabriel is obviously there functioning as one of the attendants in all those because there needs to be initiation. And what I mean by that, I don't know. Because he's not allowed to reveal it, but it's obvious that from the pattern that that's going on. You know, clearly what he's saying here is the case. You know, as we move down more and more, there needs to be some interaction going on. The other thing that is obviously in play in all these ones with Gabriel, also what we brought up just a little bit ago, that in all of these, Michael is now engaging, a being. He's bestowing himself as a being that he wasn't the generator of, the initiator of. So again, that's another little angle on what might be involved with Gabriel and this fact that, you know, that he didn't initiate them and he set the initiating thing aside. So more and more you recognize that, Gabriel, like when you get to the 7th bestowal, Gabriel's probably going to have a lot to do with getting that process initiated. Yeah, we know from the Jesus papers that, he's selecting Mary and Joseph and all this stuff. I mean, and that's just the things they can tell you. I mean, what's really going on in the deeper mystery stuff, about him making sure that this gets initiated properly? What subtle things have to be in play, in order for it to initiate properly, in order for Michael to actually incarnate in that single cell, conception? I mean, how does that, who knows? But in some way or another, he's involved. So that's definitely, we know that's part of what goes beyond what he can say here. Yeah, Jason?
Are you just suggesting where the Creator Son's mission can be jeopardized?
Remember, we're gonna read that right at the beginning of the 7th bestowal. I mean, that's the thing that they're so impressed by about the 7th bestowal. It's like, wow, he's really putting himself out there. Okay, the Creator Son right now is a single-celled organism. Whoa. Okay, now he's 2 cells. Whoa. Okay, now he's 4. This is a pretty serious putting yourself out there, trusting the integrity of the cosmos. Okay.
Well, that's making some assumptions when his personality.
Well, no, his personality is not, that is not a will creature. That single cell thing is not a will creature. But, they know that these bestowals are literal. Somehow or other, Michael is not there anymore. Somehow he's there in Mary's womb. Yeah. And wow, is that mysterious? How does that work? I mean, there's no personality manifesting.
Right. It's not even one of his brothers. Right? It won't actualize that.
There's some, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of mysteries there.
What would have happened if that embryo hadn't made it?
Well, you could just start speculating endlessly about this. I mean, this is right. The whole point is there's an integrity that has to be guaranteed. You know that never happens. Most likely is very intimately involved in properly initiating this. So what ifs that you don't want to happen don't happen. Gabriel.
Yeah.
He's obviously the key. He's the guarantor of the proper initiation of this so that it does happen as it should. Because you know there's never a mistake with one of these lowly creature bestowals. Where, oh, we just lost, you know, the Michael son in that local universe. I mean, you know that never happens.
Oh, no, it's twins.
Or something. You know it never happens, okay? So someone's got to guarantee this, okay?
Girl.
You know, now there's two Michaels. Oh, my God. You know, you just, right, you know this doesn't happen. So someone's got to guarantee that. All right.
Now has Michael passed through the bestowal experience of three orders of his created universe sons, the Melchizedeks, the Lananadeks, and the material sons. Next, he condescends to personalize in the likeness of angelic life as a supreme seraphim, before turning his attention to the various phases of the ascending careers of his lowest form of will creatures, the evolutionary mortals of time and space.
Do you want to pass it off, or do you want
to?
Okay, someone want to jump right in?
Five. The fifth bestowal. A little over 300 million years ago, as time is reckoned on Urantia, we witnessed another of those transfers of universe authority to Emmanuel and observed the preparations of Michael for departure. This occasion was different from the previous ones in that he announced that his destination was Uversa, headquarters of the super universe of Orvanta. In due time, our sovereign departed, but the broadcasts of the super universe never made mention of Michael's arrival at the courts of the Ancients of Days. Shortly after his departure from Salvington, there did appear in the Uversa broadcasts this significant statement. There arrived today an unannounced and unnumbered ascendant pilgrim of mortal origin from the universe of Nebadon, certified by Emmanuel of Salvington and accompanied by Gabriel of Nebadon. This unidentified being presents the status of a true spirit and has been received into our fellowship.
Okay, just remember, okay, so what is he? He's a third stage spirit. You know, as you leave local universe, you leave the local universe as a first stage spirit, the minor sector level, first stage, major sector level, second stage. You get up to the super universe level, you're a third stage spirit. And notice the adjective. Presents the status of a true spirit. So,
of mortal origin.
Of mortal origin. Okay. See, this is the point at which you should go, oh, boy, now it's really clear that he's doing the supreme thing. Here's where it becomes very, very obvious that there's an antecedent following going on. Think about the last three bestowals, okay? They're in reverse order, and yet they're true, okay? From a temporal viewpoint, that's illogical, okay? He can't have ascended before he's ascended. okay, but he did. It's an antecedent following. See, this is where you really see it's just like they say about the Supreme. Okay, this is where you begin to recognize that the universe is an infinite eternal ellipse and not a line that you go from time zero to time infinity on. Okay, there's a totality in play. And there are other ways of experiencing that totality than the way you and I do. You can come top down and experience. And, you know, so think about what he's manifesting right now as a third stage spirit. They can examine it, and there is no way to tell that isn't a mortal that ascended through all of the training. Think of all the training that a mortal has ascended through. Okay, he tests everything. He's learned everything that he hasn't learned. I mean, talk about antecedent following. It's exactly like he fused with an adjuster way, way back in some local system and has made it all the way up. You know, remember, as a first, second, third stage spirit, the adjuster is your body. Okay? I mean, the spirit substance of Michael now is very definitively that spirit body, and it's just as if a long old soul is completely not fused but infused into that spirit fragment, that body. He's a third stage spirit in every way, exactly as if. Okay? So, see, you're engaging potential in a way that we can't appreciate. We only think of potentials getting actualized bottom up. But those potentials are absolutes. They exist everywhere. And they can be actualized in ways that we can't comprehend, in non-linear ways. He has actualized a potential of a third stage spirit ascender. Very antecedent following, very hard to wrap your mind around, but very obviously supreme-like. And it ought to be getting more and more supreme-like because we're getting closer and closer to him completing bringing supreme-like deity into his nature. So these really deep, mysterious things about the Supreme are going to start to really be manifest. You know, not the parts that are so kind of almighty-like and more linear-like. More and more of the nonlinear universal mother aspect of the Supreme is going to be involved here. You know, and there's going to be deep, holistic mystery to it.
He could have chosen, excuse me, to do his bestowals in an ascendant way, but he chose to do it in a descending way backwards. But he probably knew the end from the beginning.
Right. And the first thing you want to do, see, is just recognize that the reason that what you just said has all of these temporal anomalies to it is that time is not like space. You know, we've been trying to make this point. It's one of the fundamental aspects of the revelation. You'll never understand reality if you choose to think about time like humans currently think about time, like scientists think about time and stuff. You know, it doesn't matter if you bring in space-time and all that gobbledygook. I mean, that's irrelevant. That's not what time is. Time is not a phenomenon like that, that you go in different directions now. Time does not exist independently like that. Time is just the chronicity of motion. What really exists is motion in space. And he's engaging the potential for motion at a certain point in the totality and actualizing it. Because, you know, you can do that. You know, if you aren't bound, you know, if there really isn't time that you have to violate or conform to, so you don't have to get into some difficulty in trying to understand this. It's just you have potential at all levels, in all ways, and you can just engage it, you know. More and more, the higher we go, the more we engage potential that way, too. That's where you're headed. You know, you're progressively freeing yourself from the bondage to low levels of sequence, of chronicity. You're not violating time or going in a different, you know, you're beginning to function in a truer way. A true spirit, you know, is true to the cosmos. Time isn't really like we think it is.
The longer that time unit it seems real to that individual, then it sort of correlates to the level of maturity.
I mean, right now, you count, you know, the reason why we have seconds is because that's basically the ticking of our awareness, of our consciousness. You know, we don't dissect it finer than that. Well, and this is what you're saying. I mean, what if you grab a hold of this much sequence, you know, or this much sequence, or what if you grab a hold of the whole infinite eternal ellipse, all sequence? Right. You know, that's all you're doing. You're just grabbing hold of more, a vaster expanse of the totality of motion in the cosmos. And so time has less and less of a, you know, if you grab a hold of just one little localized motion, you know, it just goes around like this, and time seems to be this very linear thing that ticks out its, you know, its rotation. Okay, but the more you grab things that are rotating in every way, and, well, you know, I mean, that ceases to be have any meaning. You know, there isn't some simple little chronicity to the, what you're grabbing a hold of. That's what you're transcending. Yeah. So anyway, that's the main thing that you want to, you know, that really comes out of this, is what we're just trying to stress there. See how supremacy is beginning to manifest here. Yeah.
Would you say that Michael is challenged to not engage more, to keep back and allow the Supreme to evolve in his universe? It seemed to me that would be a big challenge.
Remember, he had to go apart for that challenge in his seventh bestowal, the six great decisions. I mean, go back and think about it. That's what he's doing. He's deciding, I am not going to reveal the Supreme. I have the Supreme within me now, but I'm not going to begin revealing the Supreme yet. I'm not going to reveal power personality synthesis. I'm gonna set that aside. Just like, you know, in each one of these things, he's setting, you know, I'm setting the son part aside, or I'm setting the father-like aside as he's trying to engage some of these facets. You know, post-baptism, he has to now choose. I mean, it's there. The full supreme type deity is in play. So he has to choose whether or not he's going to let that manifest. You know, and his decision is no. I'm just going to stick with the track I was on. Let's just continue to reveal God the Father. You know, let's keep on the father-like, you know, mission here. You know, let's not even reveal some other facet of the Supreme. And we're definitely not going to reveal the fullness of the Supreme. Let's just keep power out of play, you know. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I think. I mean, you know, but there are issues with that. I mean, because there is a power personality synthesis, and it can be tapped, and occasionally people tapped it, you know, because there's no separation between personality and power. So if you engage him personally, which every once in a while someone actually did, instead of just engaging him as an animal that was hungry or whatever, or wanted to be fed or cured or, you know, or whatever. If someone actually engaged him personally, well, if you are intimate, connected with him personally, there's no gap between his personality and the power, and you immediately are going to tap into that power. You know, so that happened occasionally. You know, and he can't help that. He has no control over other people's will, but he did have control over his will. He wasn't going to choose to do that. But others touched him personally, hence they touched the power personality synthesis. They get power. Yeah. They get harmony, power in harmony. You know, they're healed, they're made whole.
I think it was good for her.
Yeah.
The one who touched him.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Not like to be abused.
No.
No, remember the Supreme. The Supreme is harmony. So when you tap that power that's tied to supremacy, you're tapping harmonious power, power that's in perfect balance. You know, if you're ill, your power is not in balance. You know, you come into contact with, you know, supremacized power, and power will instantly be balanced in perfect harmony. All right.
If you should visit Uversa today, you would hear the recounting of the days when Eventide sojourned there. This particular and unknown pilgrim of time and space being known on Uversa by that name. And this ascending mortal, at least a superb personality in the exact likeness of the spirit stage of the ascending mortals.
Dang antecedent following thing.
Lived and functioned on Uversa for a period of 11 years of Orvantan standard time. This being received the assignments and performed the duties of a spirit mortal in common with his fellows from the various local universes of Orvantan. In all points, he was tested and tried, even as his fellows. and on all occasions he proved worthy of the confidence and trust of his superiors, while he unfailingly commanded the respect and loyal admiration of his fellow spirits.
Orvintan year is about 8 1/5. So you've got about 90 and a fifth years. So this one is back in that kind of 90-like mode, see again.
On Salvington, we followed the career of this spirit pilgrim with consummate interest, knowing full well by the presence of Gabriel that this unassuming and unnumbered pilgrim spirit was none other than the bestowed ruler of our local universe. This first appearance of Michael incarnated in the role of one stage of moral evolution.
Mortal evolution.
I ran it together. Sorry. Mortal evolution was an event which thrilled and enthralled all Nebadon. We had heard of such things, but now we beheld them. He appeared on Uversa as a fully developed and perfectly trained spirit mortal, and, as such, continued his career up to the occasion of the advancement of a group of ascending mortals to Havona, whereupon he held converse with the Ancients of Days and immediately, in the company of Gabriel, took sudden and unceremonious leave of Uversa, appearing shortly thereafter in his accustomed place on Salvington.
Read that next paragraph. It kind of ties with this.
Not until the completion of this bestowal did it finally dawn upon us that Michael was probably going to incarnate in the likeness of his various orders of universe personalities, from the highest Melchizedek right on down to the mortals of flesh and blood on the evolutionary worlds of time and space. About this time, the Melchizedek colleges began to teach the probability of Michael's sometime incarnating as a mortal of the flesh, and there occurred much speculation as to the possible technique of such an inexplicable bestowal. That Michael had in person performed in the role of an ascending mortal lent new and added interest to the whole scheme of creature progression, all the way up through both the local universe and the super universe.
Okay, the thing that really needs to be emphasized in these two, it's most of what they're talking about in that second paragraph, and then back in the previous one. This first appearance of Michael incarnated in the role of one stage of mortal evolution was an event which thrilled and enthralled all Nebadon. We had heard of such things, but now we beheld them. Just pause and let it sink in how parochial the view of local universe personalities is. It's really pretty stunning how circumscribed most of their sense of things is. I mean, you'd think, okay, there's all these beings going between local universes and all this sort of stuff. And then you look at how they talk about this, very honestly. Even Gavalia, okay? The first created, a brilliant evening star, talking about it like this. It's like, well, we'd heard about these things, but, I've just never seen them in these parts before. And just look at how parochial the viewpoint is. They've heard about this sort of bestowal stuff, actually taking on the role. There was that guy that came visiting from that other local universe, and he said his creator son did it, but I don't know. I've never seen anything like that before, and I don't know if I'm gotten to such notions. It's a very parochial viewpoint that they have. There's a number of places in the book where this really leaps out at you. You're going, you don't get that? Isn't that obvious? And it's a little reminder of what it means to be an ascending son, especially now, with the universal bestowal of thought adjusters. You have an ability to sort of consciousize and make sense out of a bigger picture that a lot of beings just don't have in any sort of innate way. They're especially if they're a stationary being, you know, they just don't really have that much relationship to the vertical dimension. They function on a given level. They were made that way. That's all they know. That's all they ever do. You know, why do you do it that way? Well, that's the way we've always done it. You know, and when, you know, it's a flatlander sort of viewpoint. You know, and then one day a sphere passes through their plane, and they're going, whoa, what is this expanding circle? And now it's decreasing. You know, and they're going, what's going on? See, that's what they're seeing. They're, you know, they're actually, until they actually see it happening, it just doesn't really sink in. Look at even that last sentence. That Michael had in person performed in the role of an ascending mortal lent new and added interest to the whole scheme of creature progression, all the way up through both the local universe and the super universe. Well, I don't know, maybe I should, you know, think about that whole ascension scheme thing. Maybe it has something to do with something or other. I guess I should take up an interest in that. I mean, look at that statement. I mean, that's an amazing statement. That's pretty amazing.
The other question would be, what other bestowals paths could he have taken?
Yeah, right. See, this is a big
answer. So I'm asking that question, because one clear bestowal path was to take his fifth, sixth, and seventh as a mortal and a descendant mortal.
Right, right.
What other series of paths could he take? Because obviously,
I mean, I can think of another.
Just a second. Yeah. Obviously, pregnant in that observation you had and in those sentences were that there were other options that Michael's sons take. This is not.
Right.
If this was the only option, they would not have sounded so surprised.
Right, obviously.
There's other tracks that could have been on. What are those other tracks?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, and again, you know, why he took these tracks, see, that has to do with the way he wants to have this universe run, obviously.
But what are the other ones?
Think of something that he didn't do that you could do. He could have incarnated as a sun fused mortal, or a spirit fused mortal. Think about a local universe where almost every being in that local universe, the majority of beings in the entire local universe, are spirit fusers and not father fusers. You could speculate, it's probably pretty likely that a Michael in that universe is going to bestow himself as a spirit fuser at some point.
And could he have gone in a lot of other orders of angels as well, correct?
He could
have been a cherubim, a seraphim. There were lots of options in career paths.
Could have been a midwayer. I mean, you know.
Could have been a midwayer.
Right, there's all kinds of different things he could have done. He could have been an archangel. He could have been a brilliant evening star.
Yeah.
He could have, you know. You know, he could have been really mysterious, brilliant eating star, one that wasn't made that way but ascended that way, and somehow he didn't ascend, and yet he was just as if he had. You know, it could be all kinds of things like that.
Wouldn't that give him the complement of supremacy that he needed to be what he is now?
Yeah. So, you know, again, this issue, when I say he now literally has the supreme type deity, not the totality of the supreme type deity. He has one measure of supreme type deity. Another creator son is going to incorporate a different measure of supreme type deity into them, and that's going to have a whole lot to do with exactly who they are in their different bestowals and all these issues. You know, he's trying to synchronize with the facet of the supreme that's related to his unique creator son nature.
Right. That's why I think it had to be this.
You know, it's a lot like you and I in our relationship with the Father. That face, that personal face of the Father that you see, only you can see. Not the eternal Son. No other personality can see. He has an absolute relationship to you, personal relationship with you. So you've got a similar thing here. There's a unique relationship between a creator son and supremacy that is being actualized here.
It seems to me that it's important to bear in mind that he's a creator son, and that with these bestowals, he's acting as a creator son. He's creating his local universe, because these different bestowals are like little nuclei of unlimited potentials within the supreme, within Nebadon. So he's designed this thing to unfold in a certain way, and so he's...
And he has a plan for what all is going to, he's going to create in his local universe from beginning to end. There's certain things that he is going to do, down the road, that the only way he can do those is to potentialize himself to actualize those things. One of the things he's doing here is bringing in the potentials that he needs. You'll see this comes up in the last section. We're going to spend quite a bit of time understanding the last section of this paper. Something that you get a lot of. It's all these things. All these sections are about what he's actualizing. And then they're going to say, well, there's another thing going on. The whole time he's actualizing, he's also potentializing. What is he potentializing? Why is he potentializing? What's going on there? And we'll be able to talk about that quite a bit because we've worked through enough of the understanding of total deity to really appreciate what the little clues that Gavalia gives. He can't reveal very much, but he can give little clues. And it's like, if you've thought this through a lot, if you understand the bigger picture, if you've cracked the code back in deity and reality, if you've taken their suggestions, and actually fleshed it out, you'll know what I'm talking about here, what I'm intimating, what I'm suggesting. That's what we want to look at. Because as I pointed out, he said he's going to push it right to the limits. I can't reveal this, but I can reveal what the boundary to that looks like.
Right.
Look at what I've revealed. It has a boundary. It's shaped like what I can't reveal. Follow the boundary, and you'll know more about what I can't reveal. But the only way you can do that is to have gotten enough sense of what the potentials are in the whole bigger picture so that you can even imagine what might be on the other side of the boundary. And that's the power of what we've been doing here for the last many, many months. Trying to build up enough of our relationship to the bigger picture so we can start to see beyond what's immediately there, what's going on. What is the second half of his whole universe career about? We have a first half from here to paradise, a second half going out from paradise as a finality. We're in parallel to descending suns, okay? He has a first half descending down to this point, and then as a creator son, and then he has a second half as a master son. What's the point of that master son stage? Does he just go stasis, or is he still challenging himself towards some goal? And if so, what is it?
He disappears, but then they don't know when he comes until the very end of the bestowal that was truly him.
I mean, one of the places where that really comes into play is the complexity of the previous bestowal. What was it, 26, right? Yeah, 26 different. Notice how vague he was there. They could never figure out who the seraphim was that was him. Well, that also begs the question. It's like, well, as he goes from assignment one to assignment two, is there some suddenlies? Are there any discontinuities in that? I mean, we don't know a lot about this. I mean, there's a possibility. I mean, what if he's doing it over a vast area of Nebadon? Those 26 things. Well, he can't do seraphic transport across Nebadon. That takes, forever. Okay, if he's not doing this in a fairly localized space, he's going to have to get quickly from some point to some other. The way he mysteriously suddenly does this thing, that's part of the mystery of the bestowal, remember, is how he goes from Salvington, disappears on Salvington. Notice, it doesn't say he transports off, he just disappears from view on Salvington and then reappears somewhere, there may be the very fact that they couldn't track him, that there could be a number of things that he was doing. He might have been really hard to track because he was really jumping around.
Yeah. Missing years.
Yeah. Missing space. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's jumping over space. And again, the more relationship to supremacy he has, the more relationship to the whole he has, the more that's just logically possible. That's reflectivity. It's where you've bridged all the distances in the grand universe. Every point is as if it's one point. All those sorts of things start to come into play. You know, so his abilities like this might progress during these seven bestowals. I mean, there's just all kinds of mystery here that you can speculate about.
Still, the technique of these successive bestowals remained a mystery. Even Gabriel confesses that he does not comprehend the method whereby this paradise son and universe creator could, at will, assume the personality and live the life of one of his own subordinate creatures.
So obviously, you know, and Gabriel experienced some of this, you know. You know, he's standing with Michael on the dispatching field, and not only Michael disappears, but he does too. And then they reappear somewhere else. Like, well, that was interesting. I wonder how that happened.
kind of a silly question, but as he disappears with, we'll say, the Supernafam and Gabriel, and then isn't there a hint that he's something special with these two really special entities alongside of him? Or are they cloaked? Or do they stay in reserve someplace? Or they only appear when he gets
ready to take off? Just notice that sometimes they point out that that's a dead giveaway. Other times, you notice he, you know, he's very, you know, he says, well, they tried and tried to figure out which Seraphim he was. Well, obviously, that means that Gabriel and the Supernafim weren't standing next to it. That would be right. So, where were they? Why weren't? There's all kinds of unanswered questions here. How could they be intimately involved in it if they weren't right there, invisible? And yet, when the more you think about this, the more you realize they're not just sort of, you know, attendance in a simplistic sense. There's some kind of energy synchronizing phenomenon. I mean, it's just really, there's a lot of mysteries here, see? And that's kind of really, I think, one of the main things that the Gavalia wants us to get out of this is to challenge yourself to start thinking about it logically enough that you begin to appreciate the mystery. You know, if you never try to engage it logically, it's like, well, okay, so it's a mysterious whatever. But the point is, you don't really appreciate mystery until you start to engage it logically. Mystery is not magic. Mystery is logical conundrum. Okay? It's areas where the extent to which you can engage the whole and understand logic, the logic of the whole, this transcends your engagement. You know it's logical, but you can't access enough of the whole to see the logic of it. And it certainly is not rationalizable. If you can't, they're trying to point that out. You know, we're trying to just rationalize it, and we're totally befuddled, even when we have a vast rationalization engine like Gabriel. You know, think about how much rational consciousness someone like Gabriel has, how many dots he can connect together. Doesn't help him one lick. Doesn't matter how many dots you can connect together. That's not the blind spot. It's not a matter of vastness of mind. It's a matter of limited relationship to the whole. You just don't have enough of a relationship to the whole to see the holistic character, the logical character of it. All right. So I suspect next time we'll probably do the sixth and seventh here. You got another little question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why? Okay. Added interest to the whole scheme of creature progression.
Why weren't they interested before? Okay. This is about me, then.
No. Okay. I understand up through the local universe.
Yeah.
The super universe has seen plenty of Michaels do bestowals, right?
The more you think about some of these statements, the more befuddling some of them are. They're really some mysterious statements.
They'd only heard about it.
No, the super universe.
Yeah.
They hadn't. This is the local universe that had only heard about it. But the super universe has seen this many times.
Well, but one of the things that's coming into play here, remember, you know, he's in this fifth bestowal, he's bestowing himself at the super universe level. And And so they're going, oh, well, that's our local, you know, creator son who is intimately related at the super universe level. I guess I got to think about that level too. I've been kind of just thinking about this. Again, I'm trying to, you know, see the parochialness of their viewpoint, that they haven't even really connected that all these ascending beings that are going up through the local universe continue on in the super universe, and that, you know, that there's not a discontinuity there. And this, for the first time, it's like, oh, you know, those two are actually connected, aren't they? And that's what they're saying. See, they're interested in the whole picture now, whereas they were just kind of focused down in the trenches before. And now they're starting to think about these ascenders in their bigger, in the bigger scheme of things. And
yeah. It took Michael to give them that.
And my first thought, what? How could you not have been thinking about, how could you have guided them well without a bigger picture of the whole thing? But see, again, this is because they're designed to work very well in a little circumscribed place, and coincidentally, what they do with that limited viewpoint fits in just as it should with the bigger picture. But they don't initially have a clue about the bigger picture. They just, you know, do this little spot, and they do it well.
Chris, when we really study the fifth, the stole on what, say, whatever mansion world, we're going to be in class with Melchizedek. So we're going to be equals with them.
Not equals with them, no.
Well, no, I mean, that's what it sounds like. I mean,
well, see, I mean, you're engaging them more directly, yes. You know? But, you know, Melchizedek's are teachers. You know, they're not going to be a fellow student. They're going to be your teacher.
Professors.
But the truth of what you're saying is still there, that you will have a nature that can actually engage a Melchizedek as a teacher. Right now, think about how difficult it was the first time, or maybe even the last time, and all the other times that you've read Deity and Reality. There's a Melchizedek teaching. You know, how intimate and immediate was the teaching there? It kind of was going right over the head, wasn't it? You know, so that's, you know, you're correct that you're getting up to a consciousness. You know, they have a hard time sort of circumscribing themselves enough to engage you right now.
Well, he's teacher-student.
Right, teacher-student, an intimate teacher-student relation, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. That's the truth of what you're thinking there. Okay.